There we go. Good. Dr. Mike Davies. Mike, are you from Wales?
I'm originally from Merthyr Tydfil, yeah.
Wow, that's the heart of Wales.
Sort of Wales. Yeah. Well, South Wales.
Yeah. We actually met for the first time, as far as we're aware, in Wales, when I was visiting a church in Abergavenny, and so were you. Or in Crickhowell. It's good to have met you, found out there was a GP we could call on to deal with this very complex subject. Tell us a little bit about your church background. Where have you been?
So I've been in Reading for the last, well, I went to Reading to do vocational training for general practice, which was in the Royal Barts Hospital in Reading. And I started going to church at Carey Baptist Church, which is in the centre of Reading, quite a big FIEC church. So it's a member of the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. I went there in 1986. I saw a girl I really fancied. She didn't really fancy me. I really fancied her. And so in the end, I wore her down and I married her. And we tried to get a job when I did my, when I finished my vocational training, but I couldn't find a job. I was from Herefordshire. When my parents moved to Herefordshire, my dad taught in Hereford, in Leinster. But at the time, GP practices were difficult to come by, and I ended up as a GP in Twyford between Maidenhead and Reading. And I just retired last year, and I was there for 34 years, and I'm still married to Caroline.
And the fruit didn't fall far from the tree.
No, 37 yeah, years. Yeah, no, it yeah. didn't. But then, we're very grateful to God for I've had a great career. I've really enjoyed it and had a very, you know, we've very been very blessed in the church in Reading.
Yeah. Now, this is a very hot issue that we're tackling tonight. And it's also not a black and white issue in one sense, isn't it? Because caring for people at the end of life raises so many detailed decisions. From my own experience, seeing my mum in ICU on an adrenaline drip keeping her alive, knowing that she'd got sepsis and that the antibiotics weren't going to hit it, and having to make the decision with my dad to withdraw treatment or to turn off the adrenaline and she was gone. It's a really hard decision. Other people, you know, treating somebody with cancer and they've got, they're on pain relief that could take their life. There are lots of practical issues. So how do we avoid harm and do good in caring for people at the end of life?
Well, thank you for that.
Is there an electronic mouse in here somewhere?
Thank you for that introduction, Jim. And it's great to be here and to talk. I'm certainly no expert, although I have 34 years of experience in general practice. I'll start by just outlining the medical ethics that we have, that give us a framework. I'll then talk a little bit about what the Bible says, and we'll look a bit into the Kim Leadbeater bill. So, medical ethics. How do we unpack that? It's an attempt to provide a code of conduct. So as doctors, as medical people, you're trying to find some sort of code in which you work. And as Jim's just hinted at, it's sometimes a very grey area. It's not absolute. It's important to listen to all sides and to be open-minded. We can be individualistic, and that can lead into problems, but different people come from different angles. It's enabling, and it helps us to be able to form moral choices in life and death situations. And it provides a justification of the actions that we take. So let's look at medical ethics as a framework for doing the right thing. There's a responsibility for all those involved in these decisions to think critically and to rigorously evaluate the choices they make. So the first code of practice that you probably will have heard of is from the Greek philosopher and physician Hippocrates. So have you heard about the Hippocratic Oath, which apparently all doctors sign, but they don't. They don't actually, and it would be difficult. So I'll just read to you the Hippocratic Oath. So this comes from the Greeks, time of the Greeks. The treatment I adopt shall be for the benefit of my patients. Okay, we can go with that. According to my ability and judgment, and not for the injury, nor for any evil purpose. I will not give a deadly drug to anyone. So that's difficult, because we often give pretty nasty, toxic drugs to people for cancer treatments in terms of chemo. So that would be outside of the Hippocratic Oath. I will not give a deadly drug to anyone, though it be asked of me, nor will I lead the way in such counsel. I will keep my art pure and holy.
My art?
Yeah. Well, I think people forget that medicine is an art. It's about listening. It's about management, planning with the patient. It's not just a blind science of applying, this is this, do that. I mean, historically, I think doctors were much more prescriptive in the way they dealt with patients. But now patients are involved much more in the management of their own illnesses, and it's a shared responsibility. So that's one of the earliest codes of practice. And the issue this evening is dealing with end-of-life care and looking at avoiding harm and doing good. So the assisted dying bill was brought last October by Kim Leadbeater. Was it Leadbeater? She pronounces it Leadbeater, doesn't she? Anyway, and Lord Falconer has been bringing it to the House of Lords. And the bill is for, it's called assisted dying or termed...
End of life?
It's called the Terminally Ill Adults. Terminally Ill Adults Bill. And Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill is the technical term. So people that they are talking within the bill are people aged 18 or above, that they have to be people that have mental capacity to be able to make the decision. They have to be diagnosed as being terminally ill. So people who have considered to be less than 6 months to live, they have to be resident in England or Wales, and two independent medical opinions are required to recommend it. And then it needs to be referred to a safeguarding panel, and that safeguarding panel will have multiple specialists. So there'll be a psychiatrist there to look at capacity, and there'll be other healthcare professionals. And also the person would need to be able to self-administer the medications. So that's the outline of the bill, which got its first reading last October. It went for its second reading and then the Lords, and it's now with the Lords again. And it was, so it's waiting to go through the whole processes. So it's subject to the Lord's amendments, also to select committee input, and it can be delayed or rejected by the Lords, and they can scupper it if there are time constraints. You will have heard of legislation not getting passed because people just waste time in the House talking. So, you know,
It can be filibustered out.
It can be filibustered out, yes. And also, if it does get passed at some stage, it needs then to be implemented, and there needs to be a system in place with all the problems that we'll be talking about in a moment in terms of safeguarding the whole implication of the bill. So... one of the difficulties really practicing medicine in this day and age that we're living in something of a moral vacuum. There aren't any rights and wrongs in the same way as maybe 50 years ago. People are challenging. There's not such a sense of of God. The country has become much more secular. There's much more humanistic. We tend to be self-determining. So if we're Bible-believing Christians and we take the Bible as our standard, then it's clear that many issues such as the sanctity of life make a lot of these decisions very difficult if we want to be true to Bible-believing revelation. I mean, the Bible is clear on some things, but the Bible isn't that clear on some other things, because obviously things have developed over the years that have challenged the way we think. But it has got, and I will just give a few verses later about the Bible, what it has to say about some of these issues. So I'm going to briefly explain how the topic was introduced to me and the priorities of, and then we can talk about some individual cases and open it up for some questions. So people have different journeys when they come into medicine or into paramedical disciplines. And I would say, put it simply, this is simplifying it, that there are three types of people. There's the dogmatist, that means someone who has got a belief system, maybe a religious background or a strong personal view. So they know what they think, and they may or may not be tolerant. So there's those sort of people. Then there's what we would call an agnostic. They tend to say, oh, well, we'll do what everyone else is doing. So maybe they'll take their moral lead from the BMA. What does the BMA say? Or they'll look at some agreement like the Helsinki Agreement. And then, so you've got the dogmatist, the agnostic, and then you've got a skeptic. And the skeptic says it's all useless, it's irrelevant. Just take each case on its own merit and work it through. Now, those three conditions have all got problems. The first one, the dogmatist, who says, you know, it's either right or wrong. What happens when two things are right? How does the dogmatist do? You say, well, how can two things be right? Well, we would say that's a tragic moral choice. So someone, let's think of a tragic moral choice. So have we got any Jehovah's Witnesses here? No. I use that as an example. I didn't want to offend anyone. So Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in blood transfusions. So you're presented with a patient that maybe a child, so that it's a minor, so the child doesn't have any sort of legal rights. And they need a transfusion because they've bled a lot in a traffic accident or rupture their spleen or something. And the parents are saying, no, you can't. So, you know, how does the dogmatist deal with that? It's very difficult because they would say, well, it's wrong to do something that the parents don't want and they've got control. But, you know, I'm going to save the child's life. So you can, yeah.
They say it was alternative to blood that their children can have.
Well, it would be packed cells or something, but it would still be blood. You need red cells to carry oxygen, and if you've lost a lot, it's blood. Life's in the blood. That's a spiritual picture, but
which is
no
principle they would stand by, actually, isn't it?
Yeah,
they would say, well, that's why we don't.
Why we
the
don't?
Life is in the blood, so
yeah,
we don't have someone else's. Yeah.
So that's just touching on, and we're going to flesh it out a bit. But then the second thing, the agnostic is the one that tends to say, oh, I'll go with what everyone else says. But no code of practice that's just given to us as a set thing is going to cover every eventuality. It's always going to end up being challenged by something. When we look at all the development with embryos, technology, drugs, you know, we're pushing forward so much, and there's ethical challenges all the way about where does life start? You know, is it right to experiment on embryos? Does an embryo, does that constitute a human life? Is that an unborn child? So then the third, you cannot avoid making ethical decisions. You will develop, even if you say you're not, you know, a critical thinker, you will end up making the decisions if you have to make them, and then you will develop a pattern. So conscience will come into that, and experience. So people who deny that they work within an ethical framework are still working within their own ethical framework, because they're carrying on working, and so they're making decisions. So all decisions need to be evidence-based. We need to keep up to date. We need to have open minds, and we need to look at how that affects us. And then the second thing is duties and consequences. Duties and consequences. So to simplify it, a duty is like a right or wrong, a moral law. We describe it as a normative perspective. So we talk about human rights or duty to provide basic care, or I will not kill, or I will not kill, but I will preserve life. I will respect other people. I will show tolerance to others. Those sort of right or wrongs that give us sort of hard opinions. And the opposite of that, to the normative perspective, if you like, is something called the consequentialist. And that's very much the means justifies the ends, or the ends justifies the means. The ends justifies the means. So if you're working towards a good end, then, you know, you might fudge it in the middle in terms of what you're doing, because you're wanting to achieve a good end. And that would be talked of as a utilitarian argument, that your ends justifies the means. Sorry if this is all a bit, we'll move, it won't, this, these are the complexities of it, and it makes you realise it's not as straightforward as it gets put across by the, you know, we're in a polarised community where you're either right wing or you're left wing, or you love Trump or you hate him. You know, there doesn't seem to be any mixing in the middle, and yes. Some of this is difficult. But if we look at the existential view, in the flow of that, in a case of withholding treatment, for instance, from a dementia patient, you might think, wow, well, you know, they're in a terrible state. They've got dementia. Their quality of life is poor. We'll withhold treatment, or we'll help them on their way. Well, you know, you're then making a quality judgment on that person, and you know, you're obviously that's the flaw in the argument. If you take it to extension, then you go into the area of eugenics, where, like Hitler killing millions of Jews because he says, well, we're better off without this group of people, so we'll get rid of them. So, I mean, that's a pretty drastic end of a particular line. But that's the worry with the flow of existentialist view of utilitarianism. Your honesty and truth and justice end up going out the window, because you're following consequential arguments to their conclusions. So let's just go to the four moral principles that are involved in making the ethical framework. If you can imagine a square like that, so top left, if you're looking at it, so you've got four bits to it. Top left, I would say, is autonomy. Top right is doing good. Bottom left is avoiding harm. And bottom right is justice. Is this how you were taught? So your lecture, sorry, I'll try and keep it brief. But we're living in a society where autonomy seems to have trumped everything else. People say, it's my right, I want this. There doesn't seem to be the emphasis on maybe how it might impact on others. It's my right. You know, people say they come to the doctor, they can't get an appointment. They say, well, I pay my taxes, I should have an appointment. And you say, well, perhaps yours wasn't so deserving, and we've got a limited amount of appointments we can give. But that's how we're told, I think, from society. If you want it, have it. You know, it's like buying things. You know, if you can't afford it, buy it now, pay for it later. So autonomy is literally self-rule, and it's given that high priority in our society. And historically, societies used to look after each other more, perhaps? I mean, some societies do. And, you know, the society I was from in Merthyr Tydfil was incredibly tight, and people used to wander in and out of each other's homes. You'd come home from school. If mum wasn't there, you'd go next door. You know, it was a different feel, and people would look out for each other. So the autonomy we give a lot of priority to. So that would be things like informed consent, medical confidentiality, respecting autonomy by keeping promises. So respecting people's autonomy as long as they're honest in the way that they communicate to you. So that's given a very high priority. The second priority is doing good. So you're wanting to do the best thing for that patient in front of you. And as we will look in a minute at the end of life care, we want to do the best thing. We want to look for the benefits, and we want also then to avoid harm. Now, this can sometimes produce different choices in different people. And the example I've got is an example of, say, two ladies with presenting with breast lumps or breast cancers. And the best decision in terms of the treatment might be to do mastectomy. And for one, that is what they want, because that's the best chance of eradicating the disease on this occasion. But for another, the loss of the breast might really impact them in terms of their identity, their feminine identity, and they would prefer, even being outweighed by the possibility of shortening life, for them, it might not be the right thing to do mastectomy. So this is the sort of doing good, avoiding harm, you need to empower people. So you've got that autonomy and you're trying to make decisions of those things. And so then in the bottom left, you have justice. And justice is sort of fairness. And it's regard to competing claims. If we think about fairness, maybe we think about drug rationing. You often see news stories where some local authority hasn't agreed to fund a very expensive new drug for this particular child, and they've got it on Facebook, and they've got lots of signatures, and everyone's saying it's an outrage. Why aren't they paying for this? It might be unproven, or it might be that it is a good drug, but it's going to cost $500,000. And then that health authority's got $500,000. But what about all the health stuff they're going to do to try and bring people's blood pressure down, or stop them eating crisps, or, you know, the more mundane things, but have got better health outcomes. So they're difficult decisions sometimes for people to make, and it's easy to get sound bites. So justice will be for example, distribution of scarce resources. Legal justice is also applied, you know, is something the right thing to do legally. And more than just being treated equally, it's fairness and equality. So, you know, health workers have no special rights to impose their ideas of justice on others. So, you know, it's not right for a doctor to tell you what you should or shouldn't do with regard to a treatment option. They can advise you, but they want to give you all the information so that you're able to make the choice and regard it within this sort of framework of justice in terms of the framework of the ethics. So the autonomy, doing good, avoiding harm, and justice. A good example is going private. So you might argue that justice, that everyone should have access to the same medicine or the same treatment. What about people who are wealthy and have got private healthcare insurance and can pay for it to go privately? Is that wrong? But then should people be allowed to spend their money how they like and if they choose to pay for it? So, you know, that justice applies to that. Is it just that they do that? You could argue that they're going private, so there's another space available on the NHS. Sorry, giving you lots of things to think about. And just the umbrella over this little picture which you'll know is scope. So the scope, what does it apply to all these ideas? You know, in the 19th century, slaves didn't have any rights at all. And, you know, in under Hitler, Jews didn't have any rights. He didn't give rights to blacks and gypsies. You know, scope is the application of all this framework across the whole board. And so we look at, does it apply to embryos? Does it apply to unborn children? People with dementia and people with learning difficulties, people in a persistent vegetative state. How do you apply these more moral principles? Do they actually apply in these really difficult situations? I've written down animals here, but how do we apply them to animals? Because a lot of people feel very strongly we shouldn't be drug testing on animals. So, you know, is that wrong? And to, you know, how do we, where does the scope appear to, and then not just the individual patient or the person, but also to the family, to the doctor who's being asked, in this case, to give the drugs for the patient to take to end their life. You know, the patient and the family, the doctor who might be compromised in giving them. And so that scope, you know, encourages consideration of the problem from a much wider perspective of all the key players that are involved in the decision. So we return to today's talk, to the issue of life and death. And I want really just to give us a few verses from the Bible and where the Evangelical Alliance and British Evangelical Council, it's some summaries of some work that was done when euthanasia was actually discussed. I mean, you could argue that assisted dying is euthanasia, but that's a...
How do we make that distinction? What's the distinction between the two?
Well, personally, I don't think there is one, but because your...
Assisted suicide is where somebody is being given drugs to take their own life.
Yeah.
Euthanasia is...
But I would say that assisted dying or assisted suicide is still passive euthanasia. You're enabling someone to take their own life.
Whereas euthanasia is the doctor taking the life of the patient.
Yeah, and I guess when you go to
Dignitas, the vet taking the life of the horse or the dog.
Yes, I mean, and people would say it, you know, if it was a dog, you'd put them down. I mean, you know, and it's all often you think you feel that sometimes when you see someone in such a predicament. So we can talk about that because it's, as I say, it's grey area. It's not a right or wrong. But here's some biblical principles.
Yeah.
But that's passive euthanasia, I would say, is assisted dying or assisted suicide. They're all emotive terms. To use a term like euthanase or suicide, there's implying that you've already in your mind sort of said it's wrong. And I think that active is actually, you know, injecting. So where do we go to in the Bible? So my first point is the life of each individual human being is uniquely precious. End of. We're all made unique. Even identical twins are unique. They're pretty similar, but they're unique. We can't judge the value of anyone's life by any utilitarian assessment in terms of their life is rubbish, so we might as well help them end it. Every life is worth fighting for. And we take Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, which talks about man being made in the image of God. And Bible-believing Christians believe, and I believe, that God made me like him to be able to relate to him. So I have a spirit, which makes me different from animals. So why I feel it is okay to put a dog down, but it isn't right to help someone take their own life. So every life is worth fighting for. Exodus chapter 20, verse 13 says, "Thou shalt not kill." We are prohibited from intentionally taking another life. And then Psalm 139, verse 13 to 16, is a lovely passage, and it tells us what David thought. For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And Jesus, didn't he say in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, who can add an extra year onto his life or a cubit to his height? So we're uniquely precious in God's sight. The second point is that the Bible says life is the gift of God. So we believe, if we believe in God, an all-powerful, all-creative, sustaining God, to him alone belongs the giving and taking of life. And Job 14, verse 5, in the book of Job, he says, man's days are determined. You have decreed the number of his months and have set limits he cannot exceed. And it's quite a big thing to say, but if we are believing in a God who cares for us, he knows how long we've got, if you like. Job chapter 1, verse 21 says, the Lord gives, the Lord taketh away. May the name of the Lord be praised. So we're uniquely precious. I believe the Bible tells us that life is the gift of God. And then thirdly, we recognize that there comes a time when life is not being preserved, but death is being unnecessarily prevented. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, a time to be born and a time to die. So sadly, we all are going to die. And there is a time to live and a time to die. So we shouldn't be trying to keep someone alive if their natural life is coming to an end. Life should be enabled to come to a natural end with maximum end of life care. And we maybe discuss that as an alternative to assisted dying. So maximum pain relief, medical support, pastoral care. So those are the three things that the problem specific for doctors with assisted dying. It undermines the caring relationship, because your relationship with your doctor or your carer is one of trust. And it's based on the principle that the doctor will try and heal. When he can't heal, he'll try and sustain life and to the highest standard available. So it undermines the caring relationship. The danger of misdiagnosis. So similar to the reason for opposition to capital punishment, you know, when you've actually hung someone and then you later find out they didn't do it. You can't really do much, can you? I mean, I think Esther Ranson is a very good example, because last October she was really supportive for this bill. She'd been given less than 6 months to live. And I think if there'd been a bill in place, then she would have probably died. And then she's been on a new one of these new biological drugs, and she's had another year at least of life. And she was interviewed and she said that she's really been pleased to have that life. And yet she's still arguing for the bill, which seems a bit of a contradiction, because she's almost arguing against her own experience. But I think she's committed to the cause of being able to take autonomy in terms of your own life. So that's the danger of misdiagnosis. With two more points, each individual has fundamental rights, but these rights must be held in balance with the responsibility owing to others. And I was just hinting at that before, talking about the scope of applying an ethical framework has to apply to the doctor giving the drugs to be able to for the patient to take. So granting one person a right to demand that another person provide them with the wherewithal to take to end their life, it has an impact on that person enabling it. So conflict within the responsibility of society and the medical profession. And then the most, I think, compelling concern would be a weakening of the law, which could open the floodgates. What I mean by that is it could be started and limited to a very small number of people who've got a very clearly defined problem, they're in agony, they're end of life, and they're asking for their lives to end. But the experience, and there was a very good lecture by David Alton, not lecture, speech that he was going to give in the House of Lords, but wasn't able to because of an accident. But talking about what the experience has been in other countries, where those strict guidelines to start with have just broadened and slipped. So, you know, it's capturing more people. More people are wanting access to this particular service. So, you know, in Holland, they've seen the acceptance of principles of voluntary euthanasia leading to acceptance of voluntary of active euthanasia for mental health issues. So for depression, and we know that intractable depression is awful, but to, you know, if someone says, I just can't go on, you know, the history of depression, it tends to be cyclical, but you can help someone and try and bring them through so that they go into a better phase of their perhaps recurring depressive illness. So that's about where I was going to finish. I think it is, as David Alton described, a Pandora's box. And if we do go down this line of enabling and legislating for assisted dying, then it might be difficult all the things that came out of Pandora's box were a lot more difficult and challenging than what was initially looked for. But apparently the last thing that came out of Pandora's box, or didn't come out, there was one thing, she shut the box. This is, have you all heard about Pandora's box? I think, and this is just from David Alton's speech.
Vera's got it.
Oh, well, oh, Hope, sorry. Yeah, Hope.
She shut the box before Hope could come out.
Yeah, and I didn't know that except from David Alton's speech. But isn't that... She let Hope go, did she?
Well, we'll go and check that out, yeah.